Hello and welcome back to our rolling coverage on Iran's military action, retaliatory actually action against the Israeli regime and different aspects of it. We have been covering this from different angles in our rolling coverage, and now we're going to continue with that. So allow me to invite a couple of guests, Jamal Wakim, professor of international relations with the Lebanese University, is joining me from Beirut. With me also we have Zakir Ahmed Mayat. He's an attorney, activist, and political analyst in Johannesburg. Welcome, both gentlemen. Now let me begin with Jamal. Professor, Israeli war cabinet is debating whether to retaliate, what they call retaliate, actually, Iran. This, the action was actually, to be more exact, Iran's retaliation for the Israeli aggression against its embassy in Syria. Now they're discussing what to do, whether to continue with this, to hit back militarily, or take heed of international calls not to do so. What do you expect to happen?
Well, I believe that the Israelis and the Americans didn't expect this magnitude of response by Iran. Well, of course, Iran, 48 hours before the strike, informed the Americans that a strike will be directed as a retaliation to the Israeli aggression. However, nobody expected that it could reach this big or be that big by sending hundreds of drones and ballistic missiles to hit the Zionist entity. Well, we need to note here the reaction of the Americans prior to the strike, when they said that they will in or will help Israel ensure its protection or its defense, and this meant indirectly that the United States will not enter into conflict with Iran in order to protect Israel or on behalf of Israel. Second, after the strike, it was noteworthy that the U.S. administration and U.S. officials, including President Joe Biden and Minister of Defense, Secretary of Defense, U.S. Secretary of Defense, called his Israeli counterpart, insisting on the Israelis to consult with them prior to any reaction to the Iranian strike. And this meant that the Americans don't give a green light for the Israelis to go on and launch a strike against Iran. Now, I believe that the Netanyahu government received a severe blow. If it doesn't react somewhere, this will increase to its embarrassment, and I believe that this would instigate the extreme right wing parties of this rightist government to withdraw from the government in protest against Netanyahu not going on strike against Iran. And in this case, this will lead to political chaos, political instability inside the Zionist entity, and most probably, in all cases, I believe that we have reached the peak of tension in the region. Thereafter, I think that things will start to ease up on all fronts.
Okay. Now, Zakir in Johannesburg, let's talk about the legal aspect of it. You're an attorney and also an activist. So tell us, in terms of the rights that Iran insists that it does have the right, and according to which it took military action against Israel's military action. Of course, it differs a lot. It's like maybe comparing apples and oranges. It's reciprocation, but not as of the same nature as Iran was attacked. It was diplomatic premises hit. Iran did not attack diplomatic premises this time. It targeted military targets deep inside occupied territories. So let's talk about the rights and international law in this connection.
So from the media reports and the information that we are receiving from the Islamic Republic, it appears to be an exercise of the articles of the United Nations Charter that a state has a right to act in self-defense. That this issue of self-defense has been traversed in the law quite extensively, particularly in recent times, with the war of terror launched by America. America used two principles. That particular principle of self-defense in the second was the principles of hot pursuit to ensure that their war expanded. In this particular instance, it seems that it has become common practice that self-defense can be exercised even if the threat is not imminent. The question now would be the issue of imminent. Was the threat imminent to the Islamic Republic of Iran? I believe that a plausible case could be made for that. Because Israel has a history of perpetuating assassinations and targeted killings. I think what makes the matter grotesque is the fact that it has been raised, that a diplomatic premises has been struck, and the world dragged its feet to condemn these acts by Israel and reining Israel in. I do find it quite laughable at this stage, and this smacks of desperation on the part of the Israelis that they have called for an urgent session, an urgent sitting of the United Nations Security Council, the very same Security Council that had ruled that during the month of Ramadan they had to exercise a pause or somewhat of a limited ceasefire, allow aid in, etc., and yet they had failed to do so. The very same body that put these conditions forward, Israel is running to it now. From an international perspective, we know that the law grinds very slowly, the wheel of justice turns extremely slowly. Iran has always been on the receiving end and the short end of the stick with regards to international law. We saw the unilateral terminations of JCPOA under the Trump administration. We saw the continued sanctions on items that should not be sanctioned, and the continuous assassinations directed towards Iran's nuclear scientists and other personnel over the years. And it appears that international law was not applied by the Western world when it comes to their actions, but they are very quick to try and impose it on everybody else. So in terms of the legal argument, there is a plausible legal argument to be made by the Islamic Republic. I believe that there is a right that could be exercised. The issue would turn obviously on how imminent the threat was, but based on what is available in the open source intelligence world, it's very clear that Israel would have continued to target Iran. And they almost release a statement every day stating that they have to chop off the head, and that is to strike Iran. So I think a plausible case can be made in that regard.
All right. Now, Jamal Wakim, let's now take a look at the way that the people, both in Iran and elsewhere in the region, react. Of course, in Iran, they took to the streets, and they are still in the streets. And they are announcing their support for what happened, for Iran's military action and retaliation. And we had the people elsewhere from Karbala, from other Iraqi cities, from Lebanon, from Syria, from elsewhere, Jordan, inside Gaza. Let's see, discover the root of this and this jubilation at this level. You know, they're celebrating this. And of course, for Gaza, it makes a special difference because for at least one night, they could maybe actually take a little bit of sleep.
Well, I believe that most Arab people, the vast majority of the Arab and Muslim people, and of course all people, all peace-loving people, and those who are against the Western hegemony on global affairs, they were all happy about this strike. And of course, especially the Arab and Muslim people, who are frustrated by the unconditional support by the West and the United States to the Israeli crimes. Israel, who always is safe with impunity for all its crimes. So that's why these people considered that finally Israel was to be punished for its crimes, those committed against the Palestinians, those committed against the Arab people in general, and those committed against the Iranians also, not only in the consulate, but also all these attacks targeting various commanders, Iranian commanders. So that explains this jubilation by the Arab and Muslim people, especially that the majority of these people are frustrated with their own regimes, who are either incapable of supporting the resistance in the Palestinian resistance, or they are accomplices with the United States and Israel in oppressing their own people and oppressing the Palestinian people and preventing them from fulfilling their national dreams and rights by having their own state, despite all the all international resolutions that were passed by the West itself. So this explains all this happiness, all this, let's say, support expressed towards the Iranian strike and towards the Iranian support for the axis of resistance.
Now, Zakir, speaking of the way that the international bodies have reacted to this, especially the United Nations organization, you know, because Iran is saying, and you also rightly mentioned, that what we have done is on the basis of UN Charter and Article 51 of it, to be more exact. The UN Security Council is going to convene and to meet over this. And what do you expect to come out of this meeting? What do you expect the UN to do?
I think we can expect the general pattern. The general pattern would be that those countries would condemn Iran. Those that have been participants in the genocide would naturally come forward and protect Israel and declare Iran as a pariah. However, I think that the United Nations has become a magnifier of the larger conflict that is taking place between the global south and the Western hegemony. It's the empire versus the people. I believe that we will see a buffer coming in with regards to Russia. I have spoken to diplomatic Russian sources, and they have indicated that they will not abandon their allies, particularly in this particular situation. A perfect example of this was last night. The reports were emerging that the Russian military planes were exercising combat air patrols over Syria, indicating that if the matter were to spiral out of control, there would have been Russian intervention. The Chinese have a similar viewpoint, that they would not allow Iran to be put up on the proverbial cross to be crucified by the Western world. This is a battle that is far larger than just Gaza and Palestine and Israel, or Iran and Israel. It's a larger fight that is taking place today, and that is between the empire and of the West and the people of the South. And I think the unipolar world is over, and what we're going to see is a battle at the Security Council level, and I believe that we're going to see a deadlock. The Iranian right to respond, as I stated earlier, is a very plausible, clear right, because Article 51 does state that nothing in the Charter should prevent the parties from exercising individual or collective the right of self-defense, especially if it is to ensure that it continues peace and stability. And Israel has become a state that has exercised genocide, has gone to such extents that they have violated the most sacred forms of diplomatic protection, namely to target a diplomatic site, not just in terms of an invasion, but rather complete destruction and assassination simultaneously. So I think that there is a very plausible case for Iran, and I do believe that the allies of Iran and the allies of the South and allies of justice actually view it in a similar fashion.
Now, Zakir Ahmed and Jamal Vakim, please stand by. Let me bring in our correspondent in Gaza City. Mutia Abi Musaba is there reporting live for us from the central Gaza city of Deir al-Bala. So let's bring in Muti and ask him about the situation in Gaza as we speak.
Yes, Behrouz. Actually, the Israeli... Okay. Yes, Maruz. Actually, the Israeli occupation forces are still intensifying their attacks against the northern part of Nusayrat refugee camp, whereas over the last couple of hours, the Israeli warplanes destroyed a residential tower located in Al-Mufti Land area, which is located in the northern part of Nusayrat refugee camp. In the meantime, the Israeli warplanes also destroyed another mosque. It's Hassan al-Banna Mosque, located also in that area. So we are talking about intensified attacks that are still destroying more residential buildings and more facilities and more constructions in that area. It's worth mentioning that this is the fourth day of that Israeli aggression that is still targeting that area. That has left till this moment dozens of the Palestinian residential buildings destroyed and at least 25 Palestinian civilians dead, while dozens were reportedly injured over those continuous attacks. On the other hand, the Israeli artillery also renewed its attacks against that area. Ceaseless shelling actually was maintained against those areas, inflicting more destruction in the residential buildings and areas of that place. While on the other hand, as you know, that the Palestinian resistance are still fighting back against the Israeli attacks, fierce clashes erupted between the Palestinian resistance factions and the groups and the Israeli occupation forces on the ground, knowing that that area, I mean Al-Mughraga neighborhood and Al-Zahra town, were attacked previously by the Israeli occupation forces, while dozens of the Palestinian residential towers were destroyed as well over the last couple of months. So the current situation is still tense over that area due to those continuous and intensified Israeli attacks.
All right, thank you so much for that live update and coverage. Moti Abu Musab, our correspondent there in Deir al-Bala in Gaza City. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
The U.S. Supreme Court agreed recently to take up the unprecedented claim that Donald Trump has absolute immunity from prosecution in the criminal case over his efforts to overturn the 2020 election results, throwing into jeopardy whether it goes to trial before the 2024 presidential election. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. The special counsel pursuing federal criminal charges against Donald Trump for his efforts to overturn his 2020 election loss filed a U.S. Supreme Court brief on Monday, 8th of April, urging the justices to reject the former president's bid for immunity from prosecution on the principle that no person is above the law. The case is due to be argued before the justices in the coming days. Donald Trump has appealed a lower court's rejection of his request to be shielded from the criminal case brought by special counsel Jack Smith because he was serving as president when he took the actions at the center of the case. In his last court filing before the arguments, Jack Smith told the justices that Donald Trump's actions that led to the charges, if he's convicted, would represent an unprecedented assault on the structure of our government. Special prosecutor Jack Smith wrote, "The The effective functioning of the presidency does not require a former president to be immune from accountability for these alleged violations of federal criminal law. He added, "To the contrary, a bedrock principle of our constitutional order is that no person is above the law, including the president." Donald Trump, the first former president to be criminally prosecuted, has pleaded not guilty in this case and the three other criminal cases that he faces, seeking to paint them as politically motivated. He has argued that as a former president, he has absolute immunity from criminal prosecution for his official acts, and warned that without such immunity, the threat of future prosecution and imprisonment would become a political cudgel to influence the most sensitive and controversial presidential decisions. In August of 2023, Special Counsel Jack Smith brought four federal criminal counts against Donald Trump in the election subversion case, including conspiring to defraud the United States, obstructing the congressional certification of Joe Biden's electoral victory, and conspiring to do so, and conspiring against the right of Americans to vote. Jack Smith's view was backed on Monday, 3rd of April, by a group of 19 retired four-star U.S. military officers and other former high-ranking national security officials, including retired Army Generals Peter Chiarelli and George Casey, former CIA Director Michael Hayden, and former Navy Secretary Ray Mabus. In a friend-of-court brief, they called Donald Trump's claim of presidential immunity contrary to the foundational principles of our democracy. The former officials told the justices, "Unless Donald Trump's theory is rejected, we risk jeopardizing America's standing as a purported guardian of democracy in the world and further feeding the spread of authoritarianism, thereby threatening the national security of the United States and democracies around the world." The Supreme Court's decision to hear arguments on Donald Trump's immunity bid in late April postponed his trial, giving Trump a boost as he tries to delay prosecutions while running to regain the presidency. Trump last October sought to have the charges dismissed based on his claim of immunity. U.S. District Judge Tanya Chutkan rejected that claim in December. On appeal, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit on 6th of February ruled 3-0 against Trump's claim. Donald Trump and his allies made false claims that the 2020 election was stolen and devised a plan to use false electors to thwart congressional certification of Joe Biden's victory. Trump also sought to pressure then-Vice President Mike Pence not to allow certification to go forward. Donald Trump's supporters attacked the Capitol building on 6th of January 2021 in a bid to prevent the certification of election results. The English website of Qatar's Al Jazeera television network has also covered the same story and tells us more. The US Supreme Court agreed recently to take up the unprecedented claim that Donald Trump has absolute immunity from prosecution in the criminal case over his efforts to overturn the 2020 election results, throwing into jeopardy whether it goes to trial before the 2024 presidential election. The justices set oral arguments for the late of April to consider a recent ruling by a three-judge panel at the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit, which categorically rejected Donald Trump's immunity claim in a decision recently. Donald Trump's criminal case will remain on hold until the Supreme Court ultimately rules on the matter, inserting it into the politically charged position of potentially influencing whether Trump will go to trial before the presidential election in November. The unsigned order said the court intended to address at oral arguments whether, and if so, to what extent does a former president enjoy presidential immunity from criminal prosecution for conduct alleged to involve official acts during his tenure in office. In the federal 2020 election case, Donald Trump faces a four-count indictment in Washington, D.C., brought by the special counsel Jack Smith, that charges him with conspiracy to defraud the United States, conspiracy to obstruct the congressional certification of the election results, and violating American citizens' rights. Donald Trump sought to have the charges dismissed last year, arguing in a 52-page court filing that the conduct he was charged with fell under the so-called outer perimeter of his official duties, which meant he could not be prosecuted because of the broad protections afforded to the presidency. The motion to dismiss contended that all of Trump's attempts to reverse his 2020 election defeat, detailed in the indictment, from pressuring his vice president Mike Pence to stop the congressional certification of Biden's victory to organizing fake slates of electors, were in his capacity as president and therefore protected. At the heart of Donald Trump's legal team's filing was the extraordinary contention that not only was Donald Trump entitled to absolute presidential immunity, but that the immunity applied regardless of Trump's intent in engaging in the conduct described in the indictment. The arguments were rejected by the presiding U.S. District Judge Tanya Chutkan and subsequently by the three-judge panel at the Washington, D.C. Circuit, which wrote in an unsigned decision that they could not endorse such an interpretation of executive power. The opinion by the three-judge panel said, at bottom, former President Donald Trump's stance would collapse our system of separated powers by placing the president beyond the reach of all three branches of the government. We cannot accept that the office of the presidency places its former occupants above the law for all time thereafter.
Ocean of Dua. أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Hello everyone, brothers and sisters, I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarisi with you with another edition of the program, The Ocean of Dua. In this edition of the program, we will be with you with the explanation of Dua ul-Kumail, the commentary of different parts of this Kumail supplication by the commander of the faithful Imam Ali alayhi salam. We'll be back after you listen to the parts we're going to discuss. ومن علي بحسن إجابتك وأقلني عثرتي. Brothers and sisters, we have reached this excerpt of the Divine Kumail supplication. وَاجْعَلْ لِسَانِي بِذِكْرِكَ لَهِجَ Allah, make my tongue remember you constantly. وَقَلْبِي بِحُبِّكَ مُتَيَّمَ And my heart enthralled by your love. وَمُنَّ عَلَيَّ بِحُسْنِ إِجَابَتِكَ Be gracious to me by answering me favorably. One of the greatest blessings of Allah to human beings is the tongue. وَاجْعَلْ لِسَانِي بِذِكْرِكَ لَهِجَ Allah, Make our tongue remember you constantly. This is the tongue by which we can talk, express whatever we think, and declare our goals and viewpoints. This is how we communicate with each other. Just as its virtue and goodness are great, the tongue's vices are pretty heavy. The wise men have said about this organ, the weight of the tongue is little, but its sin is great. As the great narrator, philosopher, and scholar has said, the tongue can commit nearly 20 major sins, such as backbiting, accusations, tale-telling, ridiculing, spreading rumor, telling lies, and belittling others, etc. This is how dangerous this tongue can be. But in this part, we ask the Almighty Allah to make our tongue constantly in remembrance of the Almighty Allah. We seek His assistance in doing so. The Holy Quran has permitted only 10 types of speakings. If one uses his tongue in one of these 10 ways, it is as if he has worshipped Allah. If, on the other hand, he uses the tongue in ways other than these that are allowed, he has polluted his tongue with sin. And in fact, he has, this is how we can put it into words, he has worshipped Satan. As the Holy Quran says, these 10 types of speaking are good speaking, better speaking, just speaking, honorable mention, generous speaking, gentle speaking, speaking of belief, right speaking, honest advice, and the last one, effectual speaking. Now, let us have a look at each of these 10 types of speakings after a short break.
Through your mercy, protect me and cause my tongue to accentuate your remembrance, and my heart filled with your love, and be gracious to me by your gracious response, and cause my evils to appear fewer, and forgive me my errors.
Thank you, Allah. And we're here feeling so good about all the things that we went through, knowing that God is pleased with us too. It's not a dream, this is so true. Feeling the peace all around, seeing things we can never imagine, hearing the sound of rivers flow, and we know we'll be here forever. The feeling is indescribable, knowing that this is our reward.
The ocean of dua.
Now, good speaking is one of those types of speaking that the Holy Quran has permitted. This is speaking to people with good temper. Better speaking, however, is inviting people to Allah. These terms are all taken from the different verses of the Holy Quran. Just speaking is giving testimony in a court of law. Honorable mention is speaking well of the latest generations of the believers. Generous speaking is speaking well to the parents of the person. Gentle speaking is speaking for enjoining good and forbidding evil. Speaking of belief is the confession we make to Allah's unity, to the prophethood of His messenger. Right speaking is speaking truthfully in every circumstance. Honest advice is speaking to the orphans and to the family members. And effectual speaking is influential speaking consisted of advice, logic, and wise speech. Now, benefiting from these 10 different ways of speaking or speech, we can begin a business whose profit is known by no one but the Almighty Allah. a complete explanation of these 10 methods requires a separate program dedicated especially to this concept. But here, we try to only explain about the reward of better speaking, that is, guiding and inviting people to Allah. For example, when the Messenger of Allah, sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam, sent Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salam for guiding the people of Yemen, he told him, Ya Ali, la tuqatil ahadan hatta tad'uh. O Ali, do not fight anyone before you invite him to the truth. وَيْمُلَّهِ لَإِنْ يَهْدِ اللَّهُ عَلَى يَدِكَ رَجُلًا خَيْرٌ لَكَ مِمَّا طَلَعَتْ عَلَيْهِ الشَّمْسُ وَغَرَبَتْ. And by Allah, if you guide someone to Allah, it is better for you than all the things above which the sun shines and sets. This is how important better speaking is from the viewpoint of the Prophet of Allah sallallahu alaihi wa sallam, and how important it is in inviting people to monotheism, to Allah. This must be the touchstone, the criterion of literally everyone enjoining good and forbidding the evil. Thank you, brothers and sisters, for staying with us in this episode. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also visit our website at parsetoday.ir. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
Your Jannah, Ya Allah, Ya Allah. Don't let me go astray, cause I need you by my side. I wish to be close to you through all my life. Ya Allah, oh Allah, be with me.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
A federal judge has denied Hunter Biden's attempts to dismiss federal gun charges against him. The ruling all but ensures a trial will move forward this summer. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. The national broadcaster CBS News has covered this story and tells us more. A federal judge in Delaware refused on Friday, 12th of April, to throw out a federal gun case against Hunter Biden, rejecting the president's son's claim that he is being prosecuted for political purposes as well as other arguments. U.S. District Judge Mary Ellen Noreika denied defense efforts to scuttle the prosecution charging Hunter Biden with lying about his drug use in October of 2018 on a form to buy a gun that he kept for about 11 days. Hunter Biden's lawyers had argued the case was politically motivated and asserted that an immunity provision from an original plea deal that fell apart still holds. They had also challenged the appointment of Special Counsel David Weiss, the U.S. attorney in Delaware, to lead the prosecution. The trial is tentatively scheduled to begin in early June. Judge Mary Ellen Noreika, who was appointed to the bench by former President Donald Trump, has not yet ruled on a challenge to the constitutionality of the gun charges. Hunter Biden faces separate tax counts in Los Angeles, California, alleging he failed to pay at least $1.4 million in taxes over 3 years while living an extravagant lifestyle during his days of using drugs. The judge overseeing that case refused to dismiss the charges earlier this month. Hunter Biden has pleaded not guilty in both cases. A representative for his legal team didn't immediately respond to a request for comment. President Biden's son has acknowledged struggling with an addiction to crack and cocaine during that period in 2018, but his lawyers have said he didn't break the law and another non-violent first-time offender would not have been charged. Defense attorney Abby Lowe had argued Hunter Biden was selectively charged for improper political purposes. They argued that David Weiss buckled under political pressure to indict the president's son amid criticism of the plea deal from Donald Trump and other Republicans. Judge Noreika said in her ruling that Biden's team provided nothing concrete to support a conclusion that anyone actually influenced the special counsel's team. The pressure campaign from congressional Republicans may have occurred around the time that special counsel decided to move forward with indictment instead of pretrial diversion, but the court has been given nothing credible to suggest that the conduct of those lawmakers or anyone else had any impact on the special counsel, the judge wrote. It is all speculation. The national broadcaster ABC News has also covered the same story. A judge in Delaware has denied attempts by President Joe Biden's son, Hunter Biden, to dismiss three federal gun charges, all but ensuring a trial will move forward this summer. Attorneys for Hunter Biden in December filed a flurry of challenges to an indictment brought by Special Counsel David Weiss, challenging David Weiss's authority to file charges and claiming the indictment came as the result of a selective and vindictive prosecution. Defense attorneys also argued that an immunity provision tethered to Hunter Biden's ill-fated plea agreement remained in effect. Prosecutors say Hunter Biden lied on a federal form about his drug use when he obtained a Colt Cobra 38 SPL revolver in 2018, after he later acknowledged in his memoir, Beautiful Things, that he was addicted to drugs around that time. Hunter Biden owned the firearm for 11 days and never fired it, according to his attorneys. David Weiss's office in January pushed back on Hunter Biden's efforts to dismiss the case, calling his various arguments absurd, stunningly weak, and wholly unsupported by facts and law, and a fiction designed for a Hollywood script. On Friday, 12th of April, Judge Mary Ellen Noreika sided with prosecutors, ensuring that the case will move forward to trial, which is tentatively scheduled to begin in early June. Attorneys for Hunter Biden had rested their hopes for dismissal in large part on their claim that an immunity provision in their plea deal, which ultimately fell apart, was ratified when both parties signed it. But David Weiss's office argued that the contract required approval from a probation officer, and the probation officer never signed it. Judge Mary Ellen Noreika wrote on Friday, 12th of April, that the relevant language in the agreement unambiguously requires probation to approve the agreement. Hunter Biden had also argued that David Weiss buckled under political pressure from Republicans and former President Donald Trump. but Judge Noreika issued a stinging rebuke. At best, Hunter Biden has generically alleged that individuals from the prior administration were or are targeting him or his father, and therefore his prosecution here must be vindictive, Judge Noreika wrote. The problem with this argument is that the charging decision at issue was made during this administration by Special Counsel David Weiss, at a time when the head of the executive branch of the government prosecuting the defendant is the defendant's father. Defendant's claim is effectively that his own father targeting him for being his son, a claim that is nonsensical under the facts here, Judge Noreika wrote. The ruling marks another legal setback for Hunter Biden after a federal judge in California earlier this month blocked similar challenges to a 9-count indictment on tax charges. That case is expected to go to trial just weeks after the Delaware gun case. The website Axios has also covered the same story. A federal judge has rejected attempts to dismiss the federal gun case against Hunter Biden, according to court records. Hunter Biden was indicted last year on 3 counts relating to his alleged illegal possession of a firearm. The trial is scheduled to begin in early June. U.S. District Judge Mary Ellen Noreika, appointed by former President Donald Trump, denied the efforts on Friday, 12th of April. Judge Noreika ultimately rejected the defense's argument that the prosecution is vindictive. The indictment was brought last September by Special Counsel David Weiss. Hunter Biden was accused of falsifying a federal firearms form and illegal possession of a firearm whilst using a narcotic. Judge Noreika also acknowledged the defense's suggestions that the Trump administration had involvement in bringing the case against him to take aim at him or his father. The problem with this argument is that the charging decision at issue was made during this administration by Special Counsel David Weiss, at a time when the head of the executive branch of the government prosecuting the defendant is the defendant's own father, Judge Noreika wrote. Defendant's claim is effectively that his own father targeted him for being his son, a claim that is nonsensical under the facts here. Hunter Biden also faces federal tax charges in California and is due to stand trial on 20th of June.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You are listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Shiraz, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. Today on The Key, we are going to be looking at a very important question. This question is concerned with knowledge in general, and specifically it is about what or how we should ask questions from people who we seek to acquire knowledge from, so that we can get knowledge from them. Like, let's say you go to a person, and a scholar, or like, let's say, a very learned person, and you want to benefit from him and learn from him and gain some knowledge from him. What is it that you should ask him about, and how you should ask him, so that you can benefit from him the most? Because, as you know, asking
a question in a proper and a productive way is the key to knowledge, right? The Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam said, knowledge is a treasury, the key to which is the question. So ask Allah and Allah will have, mercy on you, for verily four people are rewarded for that question: the questioner, the speaker, the listener, and the one that admires them. So questioning is very important and significant, and it is, you know, half of the knowledge it lies in the question and the nature of the question. The Prophet said, the question is half of knowledge. Right. So in this connection, fortunately, we have some verses of the Holy Quran as well as some hadith that can guide us in the right direction. In one verse of the Holy Quran, we read the following: O you who believe, do not ask about things which, if they are disclosed to you, will upset you. Yet if you ask about them while the Quran is being sent down, they will be disclosed for you. Allah has excused it, and Allah is of forgiving and of forbearing. So basically what we can gather from this verse of the Holy Quran is that we should not probe into questions the answers to which might burden us with a responsibility that we cannot bear, or which might be too difficult for us to understand, or the consequences of which we might not be able to fulfill and bear. We should rather seek the knowledge of those matters which are pertinent for us and that we have the ability to act upon and to fulfill. In this connection also, we have a blessed tradition and hadith from the Holy Prophet who said, leave me alone when I part your company, for verily people before you were ruined because of their persistent questioning and contradiction of their prophets. So when I command you with something, carry it out as best as possible, and when I prohibit you something, leave it alone. This is an eye-opening tradition. The Prophet says that, you know, do not probe into matters which are of no benefit for you, and will lead to your destruction. Suffice yourself with the knowledge that you've been given, that is good for you and beneficial for you, and that you can act upon and that you are able to fulfill. This is what we call productive questioning. Because the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam said, productive questioning is half of knowledge. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at that which we should question the learned about in the light of the Quran and Hadith. Until next time, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
You just listened to the program The Key, an IRIB English radio with Sheikh Shiraz, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
You can also send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.